Epilogue. 5½ months later, 7 months pregnant, Braun Lamia took the morning dirigible north from the capital to the poet city for the consul's farewell party. The capital, now referred to as Jacktown by indigene, visiting four shipmen and ouster alike, looked white and clean in the morning light as the dirigible left the downtown mooring tower and headed northwest up the Hooghly River. The biggest city on Hyperion had suffered during the fighting, but now most of it had been rebuilt, and a majority of the 3 million refugees from the fiberplastic plantations and smaller cities on the southern continent had elected to stay, despite recent surges of interest in fiberplastic from the ousters. So the city had grown like Topsy, with basic services such as electricity, sewage, and cable HTV service just reaching the hilltop warrens between the spaceport and the old town. But the buildings were white in the morning light, the spring air rich with promise, and Braun saw the rough slashes of new roads and the bustle of river traffic below as a good sign for the future. Fighting in Hyperion space had not lasted long after the destruction of the web. De facto ouster occupation of the spaceport and capital had been translated into recognition of the web's demise and co-management with the new Home Rule Council in the treaty brokered primarily by the consul and former Governor General Theo Lane. But in the almost 6 months since the death of the web, the only traffic at the spaceport had been dropships from the remnants of the Force fleet still in system and frequent planetary excursions from the swarm. It was no longer unusual to see the tall figures of ousters shopping in Jacktown Square or their more exotic versions drinking at Cicero's. Braun had stayed at Cicero's during the past few months, residing in one of the larger rooms on the fourth floor of the old wing of the inn, while Stan Lewesky rebuilt and expanded the damaged sections of the legendary structure.
"By God, I don't need no help from pregnant women's!" Stan would shout each time Braun offered a hand, but she invariably ended up doing some task while Lewesky grumped and mumbled. Braun might be pregnant, but she was still a Lusian, and her muscles had not completely atrophied after only a few months on Hyperion. Stan had driven her to the mooring tower that morning, helping her with her luggage and the package she had brought for the consul. Then the innkeeper had handed her a small package of his own.
"It's a damn dull trip up into that godforsaken country," he'd growled. "You have to have something to read, eh?"
The gift was a reproduction of the 1817 edition of John Keats' poems, leather-bound by Lewesky himself. Braun embarrassed the giant and delighted watching passengers by hugging him until the bartender's ribs creaked.
"Enough, goddammit," he muttered, rubbing his side. "Tell that consul I want to see his worthless hide back here before I give the worthless in to my son. Tell him that, okay?"
Braun had nodded and waved with the other passengers to well-wishers seeing them off. Then she had continued waving from the observation mezzanine as the airship untied, discharged ballast, and ponderously moved out over the rooftops. Now, as the ship left the suburbs behind and swung west to follow the river, Braun had her first clear view of the mountaintop to the south, where the face of sad King Billy still brooded down on the city. There was a fresh 10-meter scar, slowly fading from weather, on Billy's cheek, where a laser lance had slashed during the fighting. But it was the larger sculpture taking shape on the northwest face of the mountain which caught Braun's attention. Even with modern cutting equipment borrowed from Force, the work was slow. And the great aquiline nose, heavy brow, broad mouth, and sad, intelligent eyes were just becoming recognizable. Many of the hegemony refugees left on Hyperion had objected to Mena Gladstone's likeness being added to the mountain. But Rithmet Korber III, great-grandson of the sculptor who had created sad King Billy's face there, and incidentally the man who now owned the mountain, had said, as diplomatically as possible,
"Fuck you,"
and gone on with the work. Another year, perhaps two. and it would be finished. Braun sighed, rubbed her distended stomach, an affectation she had always hated in pregnant women, but one she now found impossible to avoid, and walked clumsily to a deck chair on the observation deck. If she was this huge at 7 months, what would she be like at full term? Braun glanced up at the distended curve of the dirigible's great gas envelope above her and winced. The airship voyage, with good tailwinds, took only 20 hours. Braun dozed part of the way, but spent most of the time watching the familiar landscape unfold below. They passed the Carla locks in mid-morning, and Braun smiled and patted the package she had brought for the consul. By late afternoon, they were approaching the river port of Nyad, and from 3,000 feet Braun looked down on an old passenger barge being pulled upriver by mantas leaving their V-shaped wake. She wondered if that could be the Benares. They flew over edge as dinner was being served in the upper lounge, and began the crossing of the sea of grass, just as sunset lighted the great step with color, and a million grasses rippled to the same breeze that lofted the airship along. Braun took her coffee to her favorite chair on the mezzanine, opened a window wide, and watched the sea of grass unfold, like the sensuous felt of a billiard table as the light failed. Just before the lamps were lit on the mezzanine deck, she was rewarded with the sight of a wind wagon plying its way from north to south, lanterns swinging fore and aft. Braun leaned forward and could clearly hear the rumble of the big wheel and the snap of the canvas on the jib sail as the wagon hove hard over to take a new tack. The bed was ready in her sleeping compartment when Braun went up to slip into her robe. But after reading a few poems, she found herself back on the observation deck until dawn, dozing in her favorite chair and breathing in the fresh smell of grass from below. They moored in Pilgrim's Rest long enough to take on fresh food and water, renew ballast, and change crews. But Braun did not go down to walk around. She could see the work lights around the tramway station, and when the voyage resumed at last, the airship seemed to follow the string of cable towers into the bridal range. It was still quite dark as they crossed the mountains, and a steward came along to seal the long windows as the compartments were pressurized, but Braun could still catch glimpses of the tram cars passing from peak to peak between the clouds below, and ice fields that glinted in the starlight. They passed over Keep Kronos just after dawn, and the stones of the castle emitted little sense of warmth even in the roseate light. Then the high desert appeared. The city of poets glowed white off the port side, and the dirigible descended toward the mooring tower set on the east end of the new spaceport there. Braun had not expected anyone to be there to meet her. Everyone who knew her thought that she was flying up with Theo Lane in his skimmer later in the afternoon. But Braun had thought the airship voyage the proper way to travel alone with her thoughts. And she had been right. But even before the mooring cable was pulled tight and the ramp lowered, Braun saw the familiar face of the consul in the small crowd. Next to him was Martin Silenus, frowning and squinting at the unfamiliar morning light. "Damn that stand," muttered Braun, remembering that the microwave links were up now and new commsats in orbit. The consul met her with a hug. Martin Silenus yawned, shook her hand, and said, "Couldn't find a more inconvenient time to arrive, eh?" There was a party in the evening. It was more than the consul leaving the next morning. Most of the force fleet still remaining was heading back, and a sizable portion of the ouster swarm was going with them. A dozen dropships littered the small field near the consul's spaceship as ousters paid their last visit to the time tombs and force officers stopped by Kassad's tomb a final time. The poet city itself now had almost 1,000 full-time residents, many of them artists and poets, although Silenus said that most were poseurs. They had twice tried to elect Martin Silenus mayor. He had declined twice and soundly cursed his would-be constituency. But the old poet continued to run things, supervising the restorations, adjudicating disputes, dispensing housing, and arranging for supply flights from Jacktown and Point South. The poet's city was no longer the dead city. Martin Silenus said the collective IQ had been higher when the place was deserted. The banquet was held in the rebuilt dining pavilion, and the great dome echoed to laughter as Martin Silenus read ribald poems and other artists performed skits. Besides the consul and Silenus, Braun's round table boasted half a dozen ouster guests, including Freeman Genga and Cordwell Minmon, as well as Rithmet Korber III, dressed in stitched pelts and a tall cone of a cap. Theo Lane arrived late, with apologies, shared the most recent Jacktown jokes with the audience, and came over to the table to join them for dessert. Lane had been mentioned recently as the poet's choice for Jacktown's mayor in the fourth-month election soon to be held. Both Indigene and Ouster seemed to like his style, and so far Theo had shown no signs of declining if the honor were offered him. After much wine at the banquet, the consul quietly invited a few of them up to the ship for music and more wine. They went, Braun and Martin and Theo, and sat high on the ship's balcony, while the consul very soberly and feelingly played Gershwin and Studeri and Brahms and Loser and Beatles, and then Gershwin again, finally ending with Rachmaninoff's heart-stoppingly beautiful Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor. Then they sat in the low light, looked out over the city and valley, drank a bit more wine, and talked late into the night.
"What do you expect to find in the web?" Theo asked the consul. "Anarchy? Mob rule? Reversion to Stone Age life?"
"All of that and more, probably," smiled the consul. He swirled the brandy in his glass. "Seriously, there were enough squirts before the fat line went dead to let us know that, despite some real problems, most of the old worlds of the web will do all right." Theo Lane sat nursing the same glass of wine he had brought up from the dining pavilion.
"Why do you think the fat line went dead?"
Martin Silenus snorted.
"God get tired of us scribbling graffiti on his outhouse walls."
They talked of old friends, wondering how Father Duray was doing. They had heard about his new job and one of the last fat line intercepts. They remembered Lennar Hoyt. "Do you think he'll automatically become Pope when Duray passes away?" asked the consul.
"I doubt it," said Theo. "But at least he'll get a chance to live again, if that extra cruciform Duray carries on his chest still works."
"I wonder if he'll come looking for his balalaika," said Silenus, strumming the instrument.
In the low light, Braun thought, the old poet still looked like a satyr. They talked about Saul and Rachel. In the past 6 months, hundreds of people had tried to enter the Sphinx. One had succeeded, a quiet ouster named Meisenspecht Amenyet. The ouster experts had spent months analyzing the tombs and the trace of time tides still surviving. On some of the structures, hieroglyphs and oddly familiar cuneiform had appeared after the tomb's opening, and these had led to at least educated guesses as to the various time tomb's functions. The Sphinx was a one-way portal to the future Rachel Moneta had spoken of. No one knew how it selected those it wished to let pass, but the popular thing for tourists was to try to enter the portal. No sign or hint of Saul and his daughter's fate had been discovered. Braun, the consul, and Martin Silenus drank a toast to Saul and Rachel. The Jade Tomb appeared to have something to do with gas giant worlds. No one had been passed by its particular portal, but exotic ousters, designed and bred to live in Jovian habitats, arrived daily to attempt to enter it. Both ouster and force experts repeatedly pointed out that the tombs were not farcasters, but some other form of cosmic connection entirely. The tourists didn't care. The obelisk remained a black mystery. The tomb still glowed, but it now had no door. Ousters guessed that armies of shrikes still waited within. Martin Silenus thought that the obelisk was only a phallic symbol thrown in the valley's decor as an afterthought. Others thought it might have something to do with the Templars. Braun, the consul, and Martin Silenus drank a toast to True Voice of the Tree, Het Mastin. The resealed crystal monolith was Colonel Fedmon Kassad's tomb. Decoded markings set in stone talked of a cosmic battle, and a great warrior from the past who appeared to help defeat the Lord of Pain. Young recruits down from the torch ships and attack carriers ate it up. Kassad's legend would spread as more of these ships returned to the worlds of the old web. Braun, the consul, and Martin Silenus drank a toast to Fedmon Kassad. The first and second of the cave tombs seemed to lead nowhere, but the third appeared to open to labyrinths on a variety of worlds. After a few researchers disappeared, the ouster research authorities reminded tourists that the labyrinths lay in a different time, possibly hundreds of thousands of years in the past or future, as well as a different space. They sealed the caves off except to qualified experts. Braun, the consul, and Martin Silenus drank a toast to Paul Duret and Lennar Hoyt. The Shrike Palace remained a mystery. The tiers of bodies were gone when Braun and the others had returned a few hours later. The interior of the tomb, the size it had been previously, but with a single door of light burning in its center. Anyone who stepped through disappeared. None returned. The researchers had declared the interior off-limits while they worked to decode letters carved in stone but badly eroded by time. So far, they were certain of three words, all in Old Earth Latin, translated as Colosseum, Rome, and Repopulate. The legend had already grown up that this portal opened to the missing Old Earth, and that the victims of the Tree of Thorns had been transported there. Hundreds more waited.
"See?" Martin Silenus said to Braun. "If you hadn't been so fucking quick to rescue me, I could have gone home."
Theo Lane leaned forward. "Would you really have chosen to go back to Old Earth?" Martin smiled, his sweetest satyr smile.
"Not in a fucking million years. It was dull when I lived there, and it'll always be dull. This is where it's happening."
Silenus drank a toast to himself. In a sense, Braun realized, that was true. Hyperion was the meeting place of ouster and former hegemony citizen. The time tombs alone would mean future trade and tourism and travel as the human universe adjusted to a life without farcasters. She tried to imagine the future as the ouster saw it, with great fleets expanding humankind's horizons, with genetically tailored humans colonizing gas giants and asteroids and worlds harsher than pre-terraformed Mars or Hebron. She could not imagine it. This was a universe her child might see, or her grandchildren.
"What are you thinking, Braun?" asked the consul, after silence stretched.
She smiled. "About the future," she said.
"And about Johnny."
"Ah, yes," said Silenus. "The poet who could have been God, but who wasn't."
"What happened to the second persona, do you think?" asked Braun. The consul made a motion with his hand.
"I don't see how it could have survived the death of the Corps. Do you?"
Braun shook her head. "I'm just jealous. A lot of people seem to have ended up seeing him. Even Melio Arendez said he met him in Jacktown." They drank a toast to Melio, who had left 5 months earlier with the first force spin ship returning webward.
"Everyone saw him but me," said Braun, frowning at her brandy and realizing that she had to take more prenatal anti-alcohol pills before turning in.
She realized that she was a little drunk. The stuff couldn't harm the baby if she took the pills, but it had definitely gotten to her.
"I'm heading back," she announced and stood, hugging the consul.
"Gotta be up bright and early to watch your sunrise launch."
"You're sure you don't want to spend the night on the ship?" asked the consul. "The guest room has a nice view of the valley."
Braun shook her head. "All my stuff's at the old palace. I'll talk to you before I go,"
said the consul, and they hugged again, quickly, before either had to notice Braun's tears. Martin Silenus walked her back to the poet's city. They paused in the lighted galleria outside the apartments. "Were you really on the tree, or only stim-simming it while sleeping in the Shrike Palace?" Braun asked him. The poet did not smile. He touched his chest where the steel thorn had pierced him. "Was I a Chinese philosopher dreaming that I was a butterfly, or a butterfly dreaming that I was a Chinese philosopher? Is that what you're asking, kid?"
"Yes."
"That's correct," Silenus said softly.
"Yes, I was both, and both were real, and both hurt. And I will love and cherish you forever for saving me, Braun. To me, you will always be able to walk on air."
He raised her hand and kissed it. "Are you going in?"
"No, I think I'll stroll in the garden for a minute."
The poet hesitated.
"All right. I think. We have patrols, mech and human, and our Grendel Shrike hasn't made an encore appearance yet. But be careful, okay?"
"Don't forget," said Braun. "I'm the Grendel Killer. I walk on air and turn them into glass goblins to shatter."
"Uh-huh. But don't stray beyond the gardens. Okay, kiddo?"
"Okay," said Braun. She touched her stomach. "We'll be careful." He was waiting in the garden, where the light did not quite touch and the monitor cameras did not quite cover.
"Johnny!" gasped Braun, and took a quick step forward on the path of stones.
"No," he said and shook his head, a bit sadly, perhaps. He looked like Johnny, precisely the same red-brown hair and hazel eyes, and firm chin and high cheekbones and soft smile. He was dressed a bit strangely, with a thick leather jacket, broad belt, heavy shoes, walking stick, and rough fur cap, which he took off as she came closer. Braun stopped less than a meter away.
"Of course," she said in little more than a whisper. She reached out to touch him, and her hand passed through him, although there was none of the flicker or fuzz of a hollow. "This place is still rich in the metasphere fields," he said.
"Uh-huh," she agreed, not having the slightest idea what he was talking about.
"You're the other Keats, Johnny's twin."
The short man smiled and extended a hand as if to touch her swollen abdomen.
"That makes me sort of an uncle, doesn't it, Braun?"
She nodded.
"It was you who saved the baby, Rachel, wasn't it? Could you see me?"
"No," breathed Braun.
"But I could feel that you were there."
She hesitated a moment.
"But you weren't the one Uman talked about. The empathy part of the human UI?"
He shook his head. His curls glinted in the dim light.
"I discovered that I am the one who comes before. I prepare the way for the one who teaches. And I'm afraid that my only miracle was lifting a baby and waiting until someone could take her from me."
"You didn't help me with the Shrike floating?" John Keats laughed.
"No. Nor did Bonetta. That was you, Braun."
She shook her head vigorously.
"That's impossible."
"Not impossible," he said softly. He reached out to touch her stomach again, and she imagined that she could feel the pressure from his palm. He whispered, "Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time." He looked up at Braun. "Certainly the mother of the one who teaches can exercise some prerogatives," he said.
"The mother of—"
Braun suddenly had to sit down and found a bench just in time. She had never been awkward before in her life, but now, at 7 months, there was no graceful way she could manage sitting. She thought, irrelevantly, of the dirigible coming in for mooring that morning.
"The one who teaches," repeated Keats. "I have no idea what she will teach, but it will change the universe and set ideas in motion that will be vital 10,000 years from now."
"My child?" she managed, fighting a bit for air. "Johnny's in my child?"
The Keats persona rubbed its cheek. The junction of human spirit and AI logic, which Uman and the Corps sought for so long and died not understanding, he said. He took a step. I only wish I could be around when she teaches whatever she has to teach. See what effect it has on the world. This world. Other worlds. Braun's mind was spinning, but she had heard something in his tone. Why? Where will you be? What's wrong? Keats sighed. The core is gone. The dataspheres here are too small to contain me, even in reduced form. Except for the four ship AIs, and I don't think I'd like it there. I never took orders well. And there's nowhere else? Asked Braun. The metasphere, he said, glancing behind him. But it's full of lions and tigers and bears, and I'm not ready yet. Braun let that pass. I have an idea, she said. She told him. The image of her lover came closer, put his arms around her, and said, You are a miracle, madam. He stepped back into the shadows. Braun shook her head. Just a pregnant lady. She put her hand on the swelling under her gown. The one who teaches, she murmured. Then to Keats. All right. You're the archangel announcing all this. What name shall I give her? When there was no answer, Braun looked up. The shadows were empty. Braun was at the spaceport before the sun rose. It was not exactly a merry group bidding farewell. Beyond the usual sadness of saying goodbye, Martin, the consul, and Theo were nursing hangovers since day-after pills were out of stock on post-Web Hyperion. Only Braun was in fine temper. "Goddamn ship's computer has been acting weird all morning," grumbled the consul. "How so?" smiled Braun. The consul squinted at her. "I ask it to run through a regular pre-launch checklist, and the stupid ship gives me verse." "Verse?" said Martin Silenus, raising one satyr's brow. "Yeah, listen." The consul keyed his comm log. A voice familiar to Braun said, "So, ye three ghosts, adieu. You cannot raise my head cool-bedded in flowery grass, for I would not be dieted with praise. A pet lamb in a sentimental farce. Fade softly from my eyes, and be once more in mask-like figures on the dreamy urn. Farewell. I yet have visions for the night, and for the day faint visions there is store. Vanish, ye phantoms, from my idle sprite, into the clouds, and never more return." Theo Lane said, "A defective AI? I thought your ship had one of the finest intelligences outside of the core." "It does," said the consul. "It's not defective. I ran a full cognitive and function check. Everything's fine, but it gives me this." He gestured at the comm log recording readout. Martin Silenus glanced at Braun Lamia, looked carefully at her smile, and then turned back to the consul. "Well, it looks as if your ship might be getting literate. Don't worry about it. It will be good company during the long trip there and back." In the ensuing pause, Braun brought out a bulky package. "A going-away present," she said. The consul unwrapped it, slowly at first, and then ripping and tearing as the folded, faded, and much-abused little carpet came into sight. He ran his hands across it, looked up, and spoke with emotion filling his voice. "Where? How did you—" Braun smiled. "An indigene refugee found it below the Carla locks. She was trying to sell it in the Jacktown marketplace when I happened along. No one was interested in buying." The consul took a deep breath and ran his hands across the designs on the hawking mat, which had carried his grandfather Merrin to the fateful meeting with his grandmother Ciri. "I'm afraid it doesn't fly anymore," said Braun. "The flight filaments need recharging," said the consul. "I don't know how to thank you." "Don't," said Braun. It's for good luck on your voyage. The consul shook his head, hugged Braun, shook hands with the others, and took the lift up into his ship. Braun and the others walked back to the terminal. There were no clouds in Hyperion's lapis lazuli sky. The sun painted the distant peaks of the Bridal Range in deep tones and promised warmth for the day to come. Braun looked over her shoulder at the Poet City and the valley beyond. The tops of the taller time tombs were just visible. One wing of the Sphinx caught the light. With little noise and just a hint of heat, the consul's ebony ship lifted on a pure blue flame and rose toward the sky. Braun tried to remember the poems she had just read and the final lines of her love's longest and finest unfinished work. Anon rushed by the bright Hyperion. His flaming robes streamed out beyond his heels and gave a roar as if of earthly fire that scared away the meek ethereal hours and made their dove wings tremble. On he flared. Braun felt the warm wind tuck at her hair. She raised her face to the sky and waved, not trying to hide or brush away the tears, waving fiercely now as the splendid ship pitched over and climbed toward the heavens with its fierce blue flame, and like a distant shout, created a sudden sonic boom which ripped across the desert and echoed against distant peaks. Braun let herself weep and waved again, continued waving at the departing consul and at the sky and at friends she would never see again, and at part of her past, and at the ship rising above like a perfect ebony arrow shot from some god's bow. On he flared.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Fall of Hyperion by Dan Simmons. Copyright 1990 by Dan Simmons. Performed by Victor Bavine. Directed by Josh Horn. Copyright in the audio recording 2008 by Audible Incorporated. All rights reserved. Published by Brilliance Audio. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. And please visit Audible at www.audible.com to discover over 50,000 titles available for download to the Apple iPod, BlackBerry, and hundreds of other MP3 players and mobile devices. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.